This is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Welcome, everybody. It is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle. The opening drive is brought to you by Cherish. Another big show coming your way today. We got the professor, John Clayton, with us coming up at 4 o'clock, of course, talking some football with him. Paul Moyer, our buddy Paul Moyer, will be with us at 5 o'clock today. And then at 4:30, Tim Kirkchen will join us to talk a little baseball, as it should be opening day today. And it's kind of weird, no baseball, but the... We'll be having another Mariners Classic airing for you tonight at 7 p.m. Mariners April 2nd, 2001 opening day game against the Athletics. It's brought to you by Roofers and Waterproofers Local 54. So good stuff there. Meanwhile, Jim wrote a story that we didn't get a chance to get to this yesterday, Jim. But you wrote a story, 710sports.com, where you rank the Seahawks edition so far. And I guess the midday show used some of your material, which is fine. That's a compliment. But
no, it's not.
Give it. All right. It's not a compliment then. But Jim, give us a sense of what went into this.
Well, I just started thinking, well, they've got 8 acquisitions, 7 of them through free agency, and then 1 through a trade, Quentin Dunbar. And from Washington, and Danny and Paul talked to Quentin this morning too. It was interesting to hear from him, but yeah, I just thought, well, what the heck? I'll just rate what you read about them, what you're hearing about them, and I think all of them are going to bring a little something to the Seahawks. I mean, some more than others. Like the last two guys on my list, I've got, so 1 through 8, I've got Cedric Oboihe and Chance Warmack, a couple of offensive linemen that the Seahawks, I think, are just taking a flyer on and hoping they'll pop. I've got them 7th and 8th, but you know, the rest of the guys, 1 through 6, I think can be really big contributors, especially the number one guy on the list is Quentin Dunbar. I think he's going to bring a lot to that secondary. He's going to compete with Trey Flowers, we think anyway, at the right cornerback spot. Maybe they'll put him over there against Shaq. Maybe they'll put him at the nickel spot against Amadi, but he gives you a lot of versatility, and there's a lot of upside there. He had 4 interceptions last year. You're looking for playmakers in that secondary, and Dunbar seems to fit the bill.
Dave, do you have any issues with the order that Jim put here?
No, I have an issue with the people on the afternoon show using Jim's article and stealing our idea. That's what my problem is.
Just took the air out of our balloon here.
Yeah. Oh, let's just go and not do any work and just, you know, sort of feed off of Jim's. I'm sure Jake Heaps was leading the way. No, I'm kidding. By the way, did you see Heaps on that Twitter picture? I was giving him a hard time about it. He's at University of Miami standing there with Philip Dorsett is one of the reasons why he put it up there. The real reason Jake put it up there is because he looks pretty yoked up in the picture, you know, and so he's holding a sledgehammer and he looks like a linebacker instead of a quarterback.
Did we determine if that sledgehammer was plastic or if it was real?
Yeah, I accused him of having a plastic sledgehammer. But
no, I thought, Jake did look, you know, like he was in good shape, but he was standing next to Philip Dorsett, who looked to be like an action figure. Yeah. So it's not the right guy to stand next to.
Yeah, kind of like DK Metcalf, you know. I mean, he's one of those guys that's just chiseled. But Jim's article, yeah, I thought it was, you know, it's always kind of cool to rank things and that, you know, you look at top 10 lists and stuff like that. I was different, though, than Jim. And, you know, Jim, I went number one, Quentin Dunbar, and then Olsen was 2nd, the tight end from Carolina, then B.J. Finney, the lineman from Pittsburgh, then Bruce Irvin at number 4, then Philip Dorsett, Brandon Schell, Oboihe, and Chance Warmack was Jim's order. And I was a little bit different. I thought number one was Bruce Irvin. You know, it's funny. I love that they're replaying these games on the NFL Network. And I was just watching Bruce make a tackle this last season against San Francisco, and they got killed. They went out to Carolina, went out to San Francisco and got beat bad. But he stopped it was Mostert. Raheem Mostert was, they threw him a little swing route, and he was inside and ran all the way outside and then broke down, and he tried to put a move on Irvin, and Irvin tackled him, and he is so athletic. And I just think he's perfect for what you need coming off the edge. Plus, he's just a good player out in space, you know, and I mentioned him playing linebacker. So for that reason, I put him number one. And then I had Quentin Dunbar number two, just because I was so impressed by him. And then after that came Greg Olsen at number three, just because I think he's going to be a better weapon for Russell Wilson than we all think. I didn't have Dorsett until six. And I think the more I watch him, the more I'm going to have to see, like, how they use him, I think, is going to be the big key for him, because he's definitely fast. And, you know, he's a pretty decent route runner, and he can catch the ball, all that stuff. But I'm just not quite sure with him. He just, you know, he looks like a number three guy or a number four guy. So, but I'm sure that they have, and I've kind of changed my mind on that a little bit, but I had him at six, and then, you know, Shell was at five, Finney at four, Warmack at seven, you know, Oboihe at number eight. And so, but to me, I think the big thing was Bruce Irvin as the number one free agent.
Yeah, Dave, where'd you have Finney again?
I had Finney at number four. And, you know, it seemed like Shell. I liked Shell, but I felt like he got beat a few times. But you're going to get beat. You're blocking the outside guys. But I don't know. I just think Finney, just watching him work inside, and especially watching him play center, if they do decide to go a different way from Justin Britt, you know, I feel like he's a very versatile player, whereas I think Shell, you know, he's a tackle, no question. And, you know, if it doesn't work out for him at right tackle, then that's going to be it for him.
The hardest thing for me was figuring out the offensive linemen, because, I mean, if we're being honest, I'm not familiar with any of them, really, in terms of how good they are or not. We've talked about their Pro Football Focus rankings, and we've gotten a little insight from Keith Butler. We got a little insight from different people about, you know, Shell and Oboihe and more. These feel like flyers to me. So to me, it doesn't really matter which order you put those guys in. I'd put Finney above Shell, Warmack, and Oboihe. But those last three, those are six, seven, and eight to me in any order you want. I don't know which one of those three is better than the other, really, because you don't really have rave reviews about any of those three. So I had Dunbar number one. I had Irvin number two. I had Olsen number three. I had Finney number four, Dorsett five, and then those three offensive linemen, you just pull their name out of a hat, in my opinion, just because we're so unfamiliar. They all seem to have sort of the same reviews about them. So those three are, for me, the hardest to judge.
Yeah, well, I just think with Shell, and I had him at number six too, but I thought about putting him at five ahead of Philip Dorsett, and probably it was because you didn't have great reviews of him, Bob. And then also I was thinking, well, they got Shell, and I think they're paying him $5 million a year. And so based on the salary they're giving him, and you expect him to be your starting right tackle, I don't know who the other candidate would be. I suppose Jamarco Jones, but I think they brought Shell in to take over for Ifedi. And so, yeah, when you talk about it's just a grab bag between Shell, Oboihe, and Warmack, I think Shell probably rates way ahead of those other two guys.
I mean, if you see the reviews on him, you know, what people say about him, he's a guy that got benched in the middle of the season. He's, you know, and I know Dave has watched some tape on him. Again, I'm just sort of relying on what has been said about him, looking at some of the grades. It feels like he could be a lateral move just based on what's being said. Maybe he comes in here and he flourishes. But just for the purposes of your ranking system, to me, they're all kind of similar. Maybe Chance Warmack should be at the bottom. He seems to be he and Oboihe are the bigger of the flyers, I guess, out of those three. So I guess I'd put Shell at six and then figure out, you know, Oboihe and Warmack. What you tell me who's seven, who's eight. They're kind of the same.
Yeah, I didn't know whether those two exactly. I had them at seven and eight, and you and I are not far off, Bob. The Warmack, I guess I put him ahead just because he's got experience, but with Chance Warmack and Cedric Oboihe, those guys both have had huge, you know, missed a lot of time. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of the, I mean, if you put Clowney at the top of this list, and then, you know, and then maybe you get Griffin, this list looks pretty good, right? I mean, these other ones down here, and if we were, you know,
you get Clowney and Everson Griffin.
Yeah, I mean, if that's there, or even without, and I'm not sure. We'll talk to the professor if they think that we'll see what Griffin is, you know, gonna do. And that's why I asked Clayton the other day about, you know, a salary dump type of move if you wanted to get a guy like that. But, you know, even if you just put Clowney at the top of this list, you don't really care about, you know, Brandon Schell, Philip Dorsett, Chance Warmack, Cedric Obwehi. You're just looking at, okay, we got, you know, what's pretty much recognized as a good offensive lineman in B.J. Finney, very versatile. And then you got Olsen, Dunbar, Irvin. You throw Clowney in there, and I think, okay, that's pretty good. Then you got your draft coming up here, and then you've got the last two draft classes, you know, just improving and getting better and filling up the rest of your roster.
I think it's pretty interesting, though, Dave, that you put Bruce Irvin number one. And I know it's not exactly a cast of who's who here, but it seems like, yeah, I'm just curious what your explanation is there. You know, I look at Greg Olsen and some of the other guys that they added to the offense, and I didn't really think that the offense was any kind of issue. And I know they're always looking to upgrade both sides of the ball, but defensively, you thought Bruce Irvin was number one out of all these guys ahead of even Dunbar.
Yeah, I just, the way he still can run, he's so athletic and he plays really well in space. And, you know, just watching him, with he's still got the high knees and the quick twitch and everything that, and, you know, the performance was there last year. Coming off of 8.5
sacks. It was his best year.
It's actually his best year, yeah. So, I mean,
yeah, his best year, and he did it in 13 games, by the way.
Right, and he's going into his ninth year. So, you know, I think there's still a couple, 3 years there. But the thing that that most catches my eye is that he can still run. And that's the thing in the NFL. You have to be able to run. You got to have speed, and he's got great field speed, too. I was going to mention that with Quentin Dunbar, because I'm not sure how fast he is, but he has great field speed. Because there was a couple of times where I saw him get beat inside. And that's the one thing I think I forgot to mention about him, why I have him, you know, I have him second, but I just think Bruce Irvin is more of a proven commodity. But with Quentin Dunbar, the one thing you don't want to do, and if you're a corner, you don't want to get beat inside. Because that's an easy throw. And, you know, they were playing some not great quarterbacks. I can't even remember the guy's name in Detroit that Quentin Dunbar played against this year. But, you know, it wasn't really anybody good. But Daniel Jones with the Giants, I mean, that guy's not throwing the ball outside the numbers. He's not there yet. And he couldn't even throw to his left, really. That whole game, he threw to his right the entire time. So he didn't get a lot of business over there. But still, you know, you want to get beat. If you're going to get beat outside. Don't get beat inside. But a few times he did get beat inside. One time he got an interception off of it. And another time, you know, he made a tackle. But his closing speed is really good. Like, if he does get beat, he has that. And, again, I don't know how good his 40 is. But if you look at the way, like, if he's some players, you know, if you dangle a carrot in front of them, they're going to run a lot faster. He's one of those guys. And he makes up a lot of ground and has great game speed, I guess I would call it, because you have guys out there that run 4.3, and when you watch them play, they don't play like they run a 4.3. Then there are guys that run a 4.6, and they play like a 4.4. So I feel like he's that kind of player too. So, but still, he's second to me. If you look at his ability to run versus at his position versus Bruce's ability to run at his position, Bruce is better in that regard.
Yeah, and we've talked about that before, Dave, the speed on the field versus the 40 time, which is always deceiving. And, you know, Jerry Rice is the perfect example. Did not have a great 40 time at all. But then you look at a career of maybe the greatest football player ever, not just wide receiver, and you try to think about, well, how many times do you see him get caught from behind? Right? He wasn't a world-class track athlete, like Ross was, you know, so 4.2 whatever he ran versus Jerry Rice, who was thought to be a middling guy in terms of his overall speed, yet very rarely do you see a guy like that get caught from behind. So I think it's a great point, the football speed versus the combine speed, if you will. I mean, just watching these guys on the field and maybe it is a different level of speed when they see that end zone. When they see that goal line coming, there's just a different gear that kicks in versus running in a combine. But just looking at this list, you know, we rank these guys 1 through 8, and then Jim put together a list of guys who are still available, and it's interesting to see a couple of names that have already been here before. Michael Bennett, we've talked about him. But Benson Mayoa is a guy that was here, and I think we all sort of talked about the promise that this guy had. He looked like he had potential, and then just didn't work out here. He's gone on. He had 7 sacks, 10 quarterback hits for the Raiders last year. A guy who's just kind of flown under the radar while we talk about Everson Griffin and Clowney and Bennett and Irv and all these other guys. Do you remember how you felt about him when he was here versus what he's become?
Are you talking to me? I'm sorry, Bob.
Yeah, about Benson Mayowa.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, he didn't stand out that much, but yeah, you saw it's pretty rare that the Seahawks, they will let somebody go and then regret it. But every once in a while, you'll see that. I mean, Alex Collins, I don't know how to explain that. But, you know, Benson Mayowa, yeah, 7 sacks and 10 quarterback hits, as Jim said, for the Raiders last year. And, you know, there's nothing, you know, I wouldn't take, you know, Bruce Irvin over him, certainly. But, you know, if you look at, I like Jim's list here. And if you ask me, Clay Matthews, and I want to say Clay made like $7 million last year. I might be off on that. But if you can get him for a little bit less than that, I like Clay Matthews, and I really like Everson Griffin. But again, it's going to be a product of, you know, the salary and, you know, how much you bring him in for.
Well, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what Schneider does because it's a waiting game with Clowney. So, I mean, you're sitting there at the table hoping that Clowney comes to Seattle, but if he doesn't, then where are you? I mean, because in the next week or so, some of these names that we've mentioned here, Matthews, Marcus Golden, Everson Griffin, Benson Mayowa, and Michael Bennett, I mean, half of those guys might be gone. Or what if all of them are gone? And what if Clowney just, maybe if you're getting indications that he's going to come back to Seattle and somehow he doesn't, maybe the Jets throw a lot of money at him, maybe Cleveland, maybe some other team that you didn't expect to be entering into the sweepstakes for Clowney, especially now that Clayton is talking about $14 million a year. And so, yeah, you maybe don't get all that excited about Clay Matthews at the age of 34, or maybe you don't want Michael Bennett coming back. You look at these guys' numbers, and they're in the twilight of their careers, but still they're effective, and they might be productive on the Seattle defense next year if you were to sign them.
Yeah, I like Clay Matthews. I don't know what he's going to command. I mean, that guy is just a football player. We saw him. He broke his jaw against the Seahawks, still ends the, you know, he doesn't play a full season, plays 13 games, 8 sacks. He's an energizer guy. He's a guy that, and for me, I think it's obviously I've seen him more. I've paid more attention to Clay Matthews than I have to Benson Mayowa or to even Marcus Golden. Some of these other, Everson Griffin, you're more familiar with, but he's just a known commodity to me. Obviously playing, you saw him in Green Bay all those years, then seeing him with the Rams. I'm not sure how he fits in this defensive scheme, Dave. Is he a guy that you think fits with the way the Seahawks play defense, or is he better suited for another version of a defense, whether it's a 4-3, a 3-4, because I know they list him as a linebacker.
Yeah, I think he fits probably better in a 3-4. And so, yeah, from that standpoint, that would probably be a little bit different. But, I mean, whether you put your hand down or not, you know, I don't think it matters a whole lot to a lot of people. But, you know, like we talked about yesterday with Clowney, I mean, certainly there is there's a preference. You know, when I went to Denver, I was going from a 4-3 to a 3-4. I always liked playing 4-3. There was just something about being right over the center and watching that triangle. And I don't know if you guys remember, he used to be head coach of the San Francisco 49ers. And now he's coaching with the Baltimore Ravens. But Mike Nolan, he was my middle linebacker coach, his first job ever coaching, because he just got cut from like the USFL or something. He was a DB at Oregon, really young at that point. He was probably 24, 25, but he taught me how to read that triangle of, you know, the center and the two guards. And, you know, we would just sit there and drill that over and over and over. And this is my sophomore year in college, and it just stuck with me. So I guess I just preferred that because I was comfortable reading that. That was kind of how I started off, you know, my career as a linebacker in college anyway. So, yeah, I bet you if you ask every one of those guys, they would have a preference, but for the most part, it's like, hey, man, we want to use you. We might drop you back into coverage. Sometimes, you know, we want to, because the Seahawks did some different stuff last year. Or they had 3 linemen on the field, and then they had nickel personnel and an extra linebacker, and, you know, they were doing all kinds of different, you know, kind of weird things. And so maybe he fits in that way, but for the most part, he looks to me more like a 3-4 type of linebacker. But still, you know, if you have a guy like that that's good at rushing the quarterback, rush him, man. Don't be dropping him back into coverage. They did a few times with Clowney last year, and I've kind of voiced my criticism about the zone blitz thing where they're dropping linemen back into coverage when they don't necessarily know what they're doing. But, yeah, I just think if you're going to use him maybe in a specialized way, if you don't have to pay him a lot of money, he might work.
Well, let's take two.
It's time to take two. Brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at 5.
Take two.
Drew Brees and his wife, Brittany, are donating $5 million to coronavirus relief efforts in the state of Louisiana.
Drew Brees got a winner. A stud, man. I mean, $5 million? That's, talk about putting your money where your mouth is. And we talked about this before about, you know, some people complaining that these gestures are public and, you know, they're doing it for publicity, whatever. I will reiterate, I do not care what anybody's motivation. I'm not questioning Drew Brees at all. My hope is that somebody, their ego will get involved and say, you know what, I can do better than that. I'm going to be a hero. I'm going to go $6 million. I want it to be like an auction out there and seeing these guys step up. And we've seen it across all sports and entertainment. It is, again, the silver lining to a dire, ugly situation in this country. And Drew Brees and his wife, I don't even know what to say. What an awesome gesture. They're also, you know, coordinating meals, daily meals with people out there. I mean, it's just they're going above and beyond by a long shot.
Yeah, is that the highest number that we've seen? I mean, has LeBron chimed in yet or anything? I mean, we're just seeing it go up and up and up, and it's very cool things you said, Bob.
Yeah, that's the biggest one I've seen at this point.
Former Timberline High School standout Eric Stevenson is transferring to UW from Wichita State.
What do you think, Jim?
Well, I saw that he was leaving Wichita State, and usually a kid just doesn't say too much about it. But in the Seattle Times, I saw a quote from him saying, "Hey, you know, I just didn't get along. I didn't see eye to eye with the coach, and so he wants to make a change." And I'm sure Mike Hopkins is going to be happy to see him. He was a star down there in Lacey at Timberline High School, and you look at what Hopkins has coming back next year. You know that he's going to lose the two stars on his team and that disappointing team. So basically he's not starting over, but it's going to be interesting to watch the Huskies next year, and Stevenson will probably give him a lift. Now, I don't know yet if he's going to be eligible or not, but there's a chance he will be.
All right, good stuff. Good stuff. We'll talk more about what we got into in ranking some of the players that the Seahawks have acquired and who's still out there. Again, Paul Moyer will join us at 5 o'clock. Tim Kirkson will talk some baseball with us at 4:30. John Clayton at 4 o'clock. So plenty of football talk coming your way. But meanwhile, newly acquired Seahawks cornerback Quentin Dunbar joined Danny and Gallant this morning to discuss his feelings on being traded to Seattle. Let you hear what he had to say. Coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
It is Bob, Dave, and more here on 710 ESPN Seattle. Coming up at 4 o'clock, we'll talk some more football with the professor, John Clayton, as we do every single day. Meanwhile, we had Quentin Dunbar join the morning show and had a few things to say. I want to play it for everybody, get your guys' reaction to it. Cut number one, talked about leaving Washington wasn't all about getting a new deal. He wanted to play for a team that actually had a shot to win.
It wasn't all solely, you know, basically on a new contract. It was about just, you know, basically, you know, like I said, I gave a lot to Washington Redskins organization. It was just more of a respect factor in that situation with the contract. And no, it didn't have to be basically solely on an extension or something like that. But no, it's not going to be an issue in Seattle. You know, before the trade was given, you know, I had opportunity with a couple of teams, and I wanted to go to Seattle. You know, and at the end of the day, I feel like it's a perfect situation for me, you know, to go out there and play for, you know, a team that competes for championship every year. So, like, I'm just looking forward to that, and everything will take care of itself. You know, so I just wanted a new beginning. And I'm just going to go out there and help Seattle however which way I can.
You know,
well, you like hearing that, a guy that wanted to play here, that wants to win. It's not about the money. Obviously, he wants to get paid. He wants an extension. But, you know, at least saying the right things, that he wants to play for a winner.
Well, and, you know, that's always within reason, right? Like Jim's 4-3 versus 3-4 thing and, you know, playing for a winner. Like, there's a number there where it's like, okay, I'll take $6 million to go to Miami over, you know, whether it's $4 million or $3 million. But let me ask you guys this. From what you know about the franchises in the NFL, you know, obviously we know more about Seattle, and it seems to be one that comes up a lot when guys talk about, I want to go to a good franchise. What would be, like, the other good ones? Like, if you couldn't go to Seattle, I just, off the top of my head, I know Jerry Jones is crazy, but he puts lots of money into that, and Dallas seems like a really good franchise. Right now, San Francisco with John Lynch, I feel like that's really a good one. But, you know, places like Houston and Washington, and I don't know what's going to go on in Carolina. I mean, some of those places, it just, you know, it just seems like the Seahawks come up in that conversation a lot. They've got to be, you know, if you polled players, I'd say top three for 90% of the NFL.
Well, especially, Dave, when you hear from other players that have gone and come back, and Bruce Irvin, that was one of the things he was talking about, yeah. Because he's been to Oakland, Atlanta, and Charlotte, and boy, he was sure excited to get back. And it's the fans, too. He gets excited about, he was talking about the 12s and how much fun it's going to be to play in front of them again. And then, yeah, the organization, and Bruce even talked about the cafeteria, the chefs they have there, all the different things, the lakeside yeah. setting there. I mean, there's so many different things. And then Russell Wilson, and you've got a team that's going to win 10, 11, 12 games every year. So it's certainly attractive. And I bet you Michael Bennett's thinking the same thing.
Yeah, it's always the grass is greener, right? You know, maybe guys that come up in this situation don't understand what it's like elsewhere. So somebody like Bruce, who comes up with the Seahawks, leaves, goes elsewhere, and realizes, man, this is a different world, and you don't realize how good you had it. Luke Wilson got a chance to experience that as well, and then, you know, once those guys make their way out into other organizations, they talk to people. You know, Quentin Dunbar is a guy I'm sure has heard about it from other people, and he talked about working in cut number two, working with Marquand Manuel, who I'm sure gave him a little insight as to how things go here as well.
When making that transition, I did watch a lot of his film, and I actually, you know, I'm not new to, you know, far as, like, you know, some of the things that they do in Seattle, which I kind of already implemented in my game with the step kick and stuff like that, because I have, you know, I work with coaches who've been over there, you know, that I knew for a while since I was a kid, Marquand Manuel, which he followed Dan Quinn in Atlanta. So, you know, like I said, I kind of implemented some of those things in my game years ago, you know, so like I said, I'm just, you know, just looking to go out there and help the team whichever way I can.
So he was talking about watching Sherman and being familiar with how they play corner here, Marquand Manuel teaching him. Dave, how would you explain what the kick step is, or the step kick, as he called it?
You know what? I knew you were going to ask that question, Bob, and we're going to get an expert at 5 o'clock, so tune in, okay. Paul Moyer, who used to... because I asked him about that the other day, because I've heard it before, but, you know, basically he was saying it's more aggressive. It's about getting a jam on a guy, and it's about kicking back to the direction that the receiver releases. So, and I think you'd have to really... You know, I don't know how other corners are taught... You know, but one of the reasons why I thought that really helped Sherm here, it's not like the only reason. Sherm's a very smart football player, but he has really good hands, and Moyer will tell you that he doesn't miss jams. And if you can get a jam on a guy on the line of scrimmage, it's going to do you a tremendous amount of good. So, yeah. And then remember, we heard from Shaquille Griffin. He was talking about practicing the kick step with his girlfriend and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's just something that's different that I don't think is taught other places. And, you know, if you know how to do it and you're familiar with it, it's definitely going to help you coming into this defense.
Yeah, that was one of the things you looked at with Dunbar. Whenever the Seahawks get a cornerback from another team, you wonder if that's going to be something that they have a hard time with. We know about Kerry Williams and how that didn't work out, Antoine Winfield. There have been others. But We'll see. I just the cynical part of me is just wondering, boy, step, kick, step, whatever you call it, are they still using it? Because they didn't seem as aggressive to me in the secondary as they have been in the past, always playing everything in front of them and not getting the type of, you know, I sit there, you know, with Shaquille Griffin, and I guess I'm a little hard on him, and I know that all the metrics, when you look at him, he had a good season, and yet I don't see the big plays from him. He's gone 31 games now, counting the playoffs, without an interception. And if you're the number one cornerback, and I know there's a lot of stuff that goes into it, like maybe they're not throwing his direction as much, and maybe they're going more over to Flowers' side because he's more susceptible or whatever the case might be. But I really like those numbers. That was the reason I put Dunbar number one, is he's got 9 career interceptions in 58 games. Shaquille Griffin with 3 interceptions in 45 games. And as I mentioned, that streak without getting a pick, 31 games from your top corner. I just, when you're looking for guys to make plays, I don't necessarily think that Shaquille Griffin is your, you know, slam dunk number one corner with Dunbar coming in next year.
Would you quit picking on Shaq? What is your problem with him?
Just the lack of interceptions, Bob, from a number one corner on the team.
Yet he's rated as high as anybody on the team, and he's a Pro Bowler. He's a guy that's around the league being talked about by others as being one of the better cornerbacks in the league. It's a single category that doesn't sum up the entire job of being a corner, does it?
Well, that's fair enough, but you remember that Bill Barnwell guy we had on the other day from ESPN.com? Maybe I'm a tough grader, too. So I just I don't think Trey Flowers – okay, here's what I would say. I don't think Trey Flowers was as bad as everybody thought he was last season, and I don't think Shaquille Griffin was as good as everyone thought he was last season.
All right.
The one thing I never saw them – I didn't see them playing up press man-to-man coverage – like they did with Sherm. Again, I just think it was a lack of trust. It was a definite lack of trust there. So for whatever reason, they didn't play it that way. And yeah, well, so we'll see. We'll see if maybe this, I'm happy about it. And I'm glad everybody thinks that he's such a good player and, you know, comfortable. And now it feels like, hey, if they go in the draft and they don't necessarily get anybody to cover, because they didn't draft a corner last year, you got this guy.
Yeah, well, we'll play more. Hopefully later in the show we'll have some time to play a few more cuts from Dunbar so people can get a sense of who he is. Meanwhile, the Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred joined Scott Van Pelt to discuss what the 2020 season could look like when they actually get underway. I'll tell you what he had to say, discuss what he had to say. Coming up with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Coming up in about 15 minutes, the professor, John Clayton, will join us to talk some football, get his take on what's happening out there, who may be in line for the Seahawks in terms of their next acquisition. Meanwhile, we had Rob Manfred speaking with Scott Van Pelt, talking about the 2020 season, what it may look like when baseball actually gets underway, hopefully soon. Cut number 6, talking about the idea of a 162-game season at this point just is not realistic.
You know, obviously our fans love a 162-game season and the postseason format that we have. We're probably not going to be able to do that this year. I think that's clear. And it does give us an opportunity to do some different things, to experiment, and to make sure that we provide as many games as possible and as entertaining a product as possible.
So 162 games, I don't think anybody's surprised by that. They're talking about pushing the draft back from early June into July at some point, cutting the event to anywhere from 5 to 10 rounds and deferring payment of signing bonuses until the 2022 season. It sounds like, you know, I'll give them credit. They're putting everything on the table, trying to explore, because you, without a definitive timeline saying, okay, we're going to be ready to resume on this day, makes it really, really tough to get the season going and understand how many games you can actually play, how are you going to work the playoffs, how much spring training, even though it might be summer training at that point, you know, how much lead up are you going to need to get the season started. So I'll give them credit for, you know, really getting down in there and trying to figure out, all right, this is what we're going to do if and when the season gets started.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. They talk about the draft, and, you know, we talked about that yesterday with the NFL, making sure these guys are all healthy and getting a last look at them, especially in baseball. I mean, you're going all over the world to find players. So that definitely, I would think, you know, if they're trying to do physicals and make sure they see a guy before they draft him, that's going to be really difficult.
Well, yeah, I love the idea of what Rob Manfred's representing and coming out with, but boy, I told you guys that earlier today I read a story about the coronavirus in the Atlantic, and it's impossible for anyone right now to determine exactly when, like Mark Cuban, the NBA, you know, he's hopeful that they can get going in May, and Rob Manfred's hoping MLB can get going in May. I like optimistic projections like that. And I guess it's okay just to come out with that. But, boy, you just got to play everything by ear right now. And it's a tough one today, especially we know the Mariners. We'd be watching opening day there against the Rangers and seeing Marco on the hill and just, you know, just having spring back and having baseball back. And it's just one of those things, though, that we just got to sit back and see what happens. But I can't wait for baseball to come back. And I'm interested to see, like, let's say they play a 140-game season or something like that. And, you know, maybe in the future, I mean, who said, I know Manfred said it, but, like, do you sit there and think, oh, man, you have to have 162 games? I think it's too many now. I think people are maybe burned out a little bit on baseball. You don't need a 162-game season. And so maybe something good that'll come out of this is if they play 140 and it still determines, you know, the division champions and a World Series winner, I don't see where you're going to need 162 anymore. I know a lot would have to go into that, but I think even the older baseball fan like me, if you had a 140-game season in 2021, that wouldn't be so bad, would it?
No, I wouldn't mind it. I think it'd be a tough sell to owners who are looking at lost revenue. If you're saying, all right, you're going to tell me I've got 22 fewer games, and I don't know how many of those would be home games versus road games, but that's how do you account for that revenue? This is a bottom line business, and where does that money come from? So I'm not sure how easy of a sell that would be, but I'm with you, Jim. As a baseball fan, as much as I've grown up with 162 games, it hasn't always been that. It was at 154, and it was fewer than that at one point. So it's just increased as time has gone on. Just a couple more thoughts from Rob Manfred here. Cut number 8, he gives the hopeful outlook in terms of when Major League Baseball might get back to business.
My optimistic outlook is that at some point in May, we'll be gearing back up. We'll have to make a determination, depending on what the precise date is, as to how much of a preparation period we need, whether that preparation period is going to be done in the club's home cities or back in Florida and Arizona.
It's an optimistic viewpoint. I'm not sure exactly what it's based on. Maybe he's like Mark Cuban, and he's got friends at the CDC, and he's talking to them. I mean, you know, these guys have access to people we don't. So I hope they're basing it on something, you know, some sort of sturdy information outside of just saying, well, May seems like a good time. I hope it happens then.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, you kind of have to sort of decide where it lands. You know, there are some people that are incredibly optimistic, then there's these doomsday people like in the Atlantic, and you know, I find that it's always somewhere in between, usually, right? You have the extremes, and then it's probably somewhere in between. We're only hoping right now that that's the case. So hopefully they're more right. Again, we said this in the very beginning, like we all agreed that hopefully we look back and go, you know, we probably didn't need to do this, that, and the other, but, you know, I wouldn't fault anyone for doing that because you don't, there's so much that's unknown about the coronavirus and a lot to learn still. So, yeah, we'll see. I think for people, there's nothing wrong with some of these optimists because I think people are looking for, you know, something to be, you know, lift their spirits a little bit. So, and one of the best compliments I think we've gotten doing this show is the texters that are saying, hey, you know, you're really, I'm still like an essential worker, and I really like listening to your show, and just to kind of get your mind off it for a little while.
Yeah, you need those diversions. You need some positivity.
Yeah.
Well, no, you do, and I appreciate the comments, too, and, you know, people understanding some of the technical difficulties we've had. I'm curious, both to you guys, Bob and Dave, do you like the idea of the seven-inning doubleheaders that the Blue Jays general manager has talked about? I think that'd be kind of fun, and we talk about, you know, maybe the millennials needing things to happen quicker. That might be more appealing when you get into the fifth or sixth inning where you're getting right down to it. I know it's not baseball as we know it, not going a full nine innings, but I keep thinking to myself that baseball needs to do some things to appeal to a broader audience. And in a backhanded way, this might be one of the ways to do it, shortening the games a little bit and seeing how those things go this year.
Yeah, for one season, Jim, I could take it. I could live with seven-inning games, and if they're doing doubleheaders, that's fine. If we're just talking about moving forward, once the world returns to some sense of normalcy, no, I don't like the idea of a seven-inning game. But as this wears on and the longer it goes on, if they say we're playing five-inning games, I'm going to be happy because I'm going to want some live competition. So, you know, this season, basically anything goes. Whatever they come up with, I will support because I think they're up against the wall. And I think it's really hard. They're going to have to adjust on the fly because they don't have a definitive timeline to work with. So they're going to make the best of a bad situation. So whatever they come up with for this season, I will support. I'll be in favor of. But if we're just talking about moving forward and saying, hey, let's make them seven-inning games, I'm out on that.
You know what I was thinking, and I think anything's on the table this year. How about a sudden-death one-inning game? And I know you're going to say that's ridiculous, Jim, but how much fun would that be?
That's ridiculous, Jim.
If you just said, we're going to play one inning tonight, and if you're tied after one, then the second inning will be like an extra inning. I don't know. I was just sitting here. I got my mind just wandering all different kinds of places, but I would be entertained by that. If I went to T-Mobile Park and they said, hey, we're going to have a one inning game tonight, what the hell? You know, you'd get two beers for sure. You wouldn't order just one. You get two because the game might be over in 30 minutes.
Yeah. Meanwhile, people are sitting in traffic and they miss the entire game trying to get there for that one inning. So it presents a few problems. We're going to talk some football coming up. How would the professor rank the Seahawks free agents so far? We gave our rankings earlier. We'll ask him to do the same. That's coming up with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.